Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
It's still very, very strong growth. This is up again, 7.4%.
Talking farmland values, USDA economist Sean Arida.
And I think moving into this, you know, there had been a lot of concern, again, with rising interest rates. The Fed, you know, had ramped it up at a very unprecedented level of acceleration to combat inflation. There had been talk about possible recession and commodity prices have been easing. Input prices are still elevated. So we thought for the farmland values that maybe this had would lead to some softening. But, you know, the 7.4% on top of the 12.4% we had last year, that's still very, very strong. I would describe it as being very, you know, very resilient to some of those headwinds that were in play.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We're at a critical time here in the corn growing season, and it's something we're watching weekly at this point.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center. She's focused on what feeders are watching right now.
You don't see nearly as much reaction from that feeder cattle contract as you might in a year where cattle supplies are a little bit bigger. And so maybe that interplay isn't as important as it sometimes is. But the corn market has the ability to kind of put on a few different scenarios still at this point. So we're going to get USDA's NASA's first cut at what they think yield will be here in the next couple of weeks. But we won't get the objective yield where they go out and actually count the corn on the stocks and then actually open some ears and get our first objective yield in October. So until then, we're really relying on private data sources and anecdotal information. NAS will release a number here in August that's based on satellite imagery and some other more survey type work. And so we'll get a better and better idea moving forward, but it could be a relatively large surprise. Early on, the WASD was projecting a 180 bushel yield. That's quite a bit higher than where we are today. And I would guess that they're going to come down just based on how much dryness is out there. But if you, you know, if you're talking knocking off 5 or 10 bushels, all of a sudden, maybe that corn crop starts to matter a little bit more to the feeder cattle market.
That's the feeder side of the equation. But what about boxed beef?
Boxed beef cutout has come down quite a bit in the last couple of weeks. So we're still above $3 a pound on choice, and we're sitting at $2.76 on select at the end of last week. That was on August 4th. Still historically large values, but definitely softer than maybe it was earlier this summer. And some of that has been some decline in some of the primal values. Rib values are still fairly strong. But one of the things we're watching is this trimmings market. And we generally look at two types of trimmings. We look at the 90% trim, which is going to come primarily from those cull cows. And then we look at the 50% trim, which is going to primarily come from the fed animals. And both have seen some very interesting interplays with each other as well as the market. So if you think about 50% trim, it's come down to about $1.60 after being closer to up around $2 earlier this summer. That's still 52% above a year ago, that $1.60 number. And so that's an enormously high price for 50% trim. And when you think about how that impacts things like the cutout is probably representative of about 8 to 10% of that overall carcass. But with those high prices, it's commanding a much higher value percentage of that cutout than maybe it typically does. And so that's pretty interesting. Now, why has that 50% trim really gone up? Well, some of it is we're slaughtering a few less fed animals, right, as cattle supplies tighten. But the other piece of this might be that we imported a lot of product in May and presumably in June. We haven't gotten that data yet. But May imports were up about 6%. So that's going to be a lot of lean trimmed beef that may need 50s to mix to create some ground product mixes. On the 90% trimmings domestically, those are at $2.95 a pound. That is a huge, huge price. That's up about 9% over last year. And I think it might be record high. I didn't actually check, but it's got to be close at this point. Now, the five-year average is about $2.37. So some very strong prices in that trimmings mix. And that's got to be bringing the cutout down a little bit as we've seen a little bit weaker 50% trim value.
And you're listening to Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's a lot of reasons for optimism.
Speaking at the recent Aspen Institute's program on building a more resilient U.S. economy, the former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Cecilia Rouse.
This economy looks like, you know, it's possible we will achieve this soft landing, softish landing that the Federal Reserve is trying to, is aiming for. But what I would argue is that I think what many people are anticipating is it's the last little bit may be more difficult to achieve than the first cooling of inflation. But on the whole, this has been a remarkably resilient economy.
One of the questions centered around industrial policy.
So first of all, I do believe that there are places where, one, we've been behind the rest of the world in terms of doing some industrial policy, and especially when there's a national security need. But I think that there are other reasons why we might want to be doing more industrial policy than we have historically. I want to say one thing about the government and the public sector. I, for one, believe very strongly in the private sector. The private sector, the idea that a single central planner has all of the information and is going to get it all right. But let's not over-torque on, the private sector makes mistakes too. And we saw that during the pandemic when auto industry, they just shut down and, the rental cars, they liquidated their fleets, which generated some of the pressure in the used car market actually coming out of the pandemic because they weren't far-sighted enough. Or if we go back to supply chains, it's very interesting how our supply chains are so complicated that the auto industry, they actually do not have full visibility into their supply chains. So the Commerce Department was actually convening the auto industry and trying to help facilitate that information. And I kept saying, what's the role for government here? Don't they have an incentive to understand their supply chains? You would think that, this is within their business. But they did not have full information. Some of it's for lack of trust up and down because the suppliers don't want to give away too much information because they're working with multiple auto, companies or whatever it might be. And so those supply chains are so complicated that there can be a role for government in actually helping the private sector work better. So I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. But going to the broader, more expansive industrial policy, coming out of this convening, there will be a volume, and one of the papers in the volume is a very interesting paper by a professor at the University of Pennsylvania named Han Mingfeng, and it's on China. But one of the observations that he makes, and he says this is his interpretation of the data from Japan and China, where there has been more industrial policy, is that industrial policy can be quite effective when you're trying to catch up, which is where I would argue in terms of chips we're actually trying to get back. And I might argue even in terms of the EV market that maybe we're behind. We need to do some catch-up. But it's not in his observation, it hasn't been as effective if you're trying to push forward on the frontier. So I think there may be a role now because the private sector, especially like dealing with something as existential as climate change, the private sector would eventually get it there. There are many, social benefits that maybe won't be internalized by the private sector. But let's stipulate that eventually we get there, but not very quickly, right? The market signals, the price signals, we haven't gotten all of the information there. There could be a role, and part of what Bidenomics is about is trying to speed along our investments in green energy so that we can make progress much more quickly in making that transition.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Sorghum started off the year okay, but we did see an increase in heat late in the month, also some dryness in some of the key production areas.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looking at crops in drought.
By August 1st, 55% of the U.S. sorghum production area in drought. Now, cotton, interesting story there because some of the hardest hit areas by the July heat were in the Texas cotton production areas. Still, though, by August 1st, only 20% of the U.S. cotton production area in drought. But given the importance of Texas to that national picture and the fact that some of that heat hit areas that aren't actually experiencing drought, we do see relatively low cotton conditions because of the degradation in conditions in Texas. As we move to the far north, one crop that was a relatively disappointing performance late in the year was spring wheat. We saw some real sharp declines in condition, and you can really blame that on increasing drought late in the growing season. As we started the month of July, just 15% of the U.S. spring wheat production area in drought. By August 1st, that number had risen, almost tripled to 44%.
What's it mean for corn and soybeans, especially in the Midwest? Gary Schnitke, University of Illinois Ag Economist.
Throughout the summer of 2023, much of the Midwest has been in a drought or an unusual dryness. The drought monitor indicated that Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Minnesota, and Wisconsin were all dry or in drought. What does this mean for yields? To look at that, we're going to compare 2023 to previous years. The drought monitor hasn't existed since 2020, and there have been 3 years in which the percent of Illinois in dry conditions has been over 90% at this point in time. That was in 2005, 2012, and 2023. When we look at those 3 years, they followed different paths as we went through that time point. In 2023, we reached dry conditions in the middle of June, where we had 100% of Illinois in dry conditions. That has since backed off a bit, such that at the end of July and first part of August, we are still above 90%, but not all of Illinois is in dry conditions. That compares to 2012, where we reached 100% of Illinois in dry conditions, and it stayed that way through much of August. If we look at the severity of the conditions in 2012 versus 2023, and that severity is based on the amount of land in those higher drought conditions, we see that in 2023, in Illinois, we backed off a bit on that drought score compared to 2012, where that drought index just kept going up and up. If we make a comparison to 2005, what we see is that in 2005, less of Illinois was in dry and drought conditions until mid-July. Then they're roughly the same. In 2005, the drought score, or the percent of land that is in higher condition, increased all through the year and was higher in 2005 compared to where it is at today. What does that mean for yields? If we look at those 3 years, 2005, 2012, and then 2023, in 2012, we had much lower yields compared to the trend yield. 2005, we were below trend. If we look at this year, 2023, that would suggest that we'll be below trend for 2023. For soybeans, we again look at those 3 years, 2005, 2012, and 2023. 2012, we were below trend, but in 2005, we were actually above trend. At this point in time, very little can be said about the yields of soybeans.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So the June cold storage number came in fairly low. It was actually below the five-year average in terms of total beef on hand. And most of that product is going to be boneless beef.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
So some of that may be imports. It doesn't break out that specifically, but generally speaking, we know it's probably product that's going to be, that could be ground. And specifically, boneless product was down 20% below a year ago, whereas beef cuts, so bone-in product, was down only about 25%. And these aren't necessarily worrisome low numbers because we are in the summer where typically we do see drawdowns in cold storage. But the key probably will be is if we add pounds back into cold storage coming into this fall and winter, because typically that is when you see those volumes increase. So if we stayed at this level, that might be more of a concern moving forward. And with our lower cattle supplies and just watching what exports and imports do, I would expect this number to relatively stay low, but will likely follow that seasonal pattern still.
Says despite some rainfall earlier this year, the herd continues to contract.
The beef cow herd is still largely, we're still culling quite a few cows. It's just a lot lower of a level than a year ago. So year to date, that slaughter number is down about 13%. And we saw in the July 1 cattle inventory that beef herd is still contracting quite a bit. But the other one we look at, and this is going to be important to that 90% trim market, is the dairy cull cow market. And so dairy cattle they have been increasing their slaughter levels. They're up about 6% year to date. Now, generally speaking, in terms of relative proportion, beef cows are the larger proportion of that market than dairy cows, but they're getting quite close together. So last week we slaughtered about 61,000 dairy cows compared to 65,000 or 6,000 beef cows. And so they're getting closer together. Generally, summer is when the dairy cow slaughter numbers are a little bit lower. So to see that increasing at this time of year is a little bit interesting. But a lot of that has to do with the margins in the dairy market. And alfalfa, key input for dairies, that has been high all of last year due to drought. It's continued to stay high because we didn't get as many acres and yield is still probably recovering. It's also a little bit early maybe to see enough forage production stock stack up and have that really be alleviated. But the bigger thing is that milk price has collapsed. I mean, they are just seeing very low milk prices at the farm. Now, the all milk price, so that's a blended milk price, is down about 33% from a year ago. And so when you think about margins at the dairy per hundredweight of milk, that has compressed to levels not seen in quite a few years. Last year, margins were fairly good, one of the better years we've seen in the last couple, and they've pretty much collapsed at this point. Milk feed ratio, very low. That's a measure released by NASS. So we generally would see a lot of contraction in the dairy herd at this point in time. We haven't seen that many cows exit the system. So on the dairy cow side, unlike beef cows, we receive a monthly number on inventory. And the beginning, we began the year at about 9.4 million head, an increase in the first quarter, about 40,000 head. We've dropped back down to that 9.4 million head. So lost about 40,000 cows net out of that herd. And I would expect that to continue, which means more dairy cows are going to enter that beef supply chain and add volume to that 90% trim market.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You talk about decoupling. The other word is de-risking. And for those of you who follow this closely, you know, it kind of depends what you're talking about.
Rob Portman, former senator from Ohio before that, was the 14th U.S. trade representative, also served as a director of the OMB. Speaking recently at the Aspen Institute's program on building a more resilient U.S. economy.
Gwyneth Paltrow once famously said about her divorce, it was a conscious uncoupling. I hope we're not getting divorced from China, because it probably is not a good idea for our economy. But I'm going to plagiarize from her a little bit and suggest that the best way to go forward is conscious, strategic de-risking. What I mean by that, and I think that's what's happening. The private sector is beginning to sometimes friend source, in other words, go to other countries that are more friendly to us. That would include Vietnam or Indonesia or Thailand or Mexico, for that matter. And so they are kind of de-risking by not being so dependent on China, as we saw during the pandemic. That has its negative consequences. But the question is, what is strategic and what is not? And this is where, going back to the famous actress again, you know, we need to be conscious about this. So as we are determining how we deal with China, I think we have to be careful to divide what is truly a national security risk, as an example, or perhaps some strategic economic risks, like artificial intelligence, as an example, or maybe quantum computing, and kind of everything else, where we actually have a very healthy trade relationship with China. Actually, last year, China sent us more exports than ever. It was actually a record year. This year, it won't be, I don't believe. Some people think, let's just cut off entirely from China, and why not? So I brought this with me, which is the Aspen Economic Strategy Group water bottle, which all of us received. That's where it's made. So if we're going to cut off water bottles and toys, it will have an impact on the cost of products that, you know, people find at Walmart. And those are not strategic.
But the former U.S. trade representative says we're falling behind in trade.
I will say, as a former U.S. trade representative who negotiated a lot of these agreements, we have fallen behind in terms of trade. And it's a conscious decision on our part not to engage in trade agreements for trade opening. And that's put us behind the rest of the world because they continue, our allies and countries like China, our adversaries, continue to make trade arrangements to lower the barriers to trade. And so I do think, I don't know if that's what he was getting at, but part of Bretton Woods was to have a system, was an international rules system. Some countries don't follow that, like China. I'm talking about the subsidization and the dumping earlier. But in general, what we have done as a country has been in a leadership role to encourage a rules-based system around the world for more trade. And our military does protect those trade routes, by the way. For people who don't think it's important for us to have a presence in Indo-Pacific, we basically keep, you know, the Sea of Japan open and the Sea of China open, and we keep the, you know, the straits open in the Middle East for oil. So I think the United States needs to re-engage in trade in a positive way, level playing field, understanding the good points that Cecilia made earlier about how they're uneven. Advantages and some disadvantages to certain groups, but we cannot step back from trade and allow the rest of the world to take advantage of these deficiencies when our economy will be weakened by that.
Former Ohio Senator Rob Portman. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Taking a look at some of the livestock numbers for the month of July.
Brad Rippey's a meteorologist with USDA looking into drought.
First of all, hay production area in drought, 30% on August 1st, down slightly from 32% at the beginning of the month. And then the U.S. cattle inventory in drought, the current number, August 1st, 37% of the U.S. cattle inventory in drought, down 41% from June 27th.
But we've got to consider the heat as well. Dr. Mark Johnson's Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist.
And it's the time of year in Oklahoma to keep heat stress in mind, particularly heat stress that can occur in cow-calf production systems. Now, the typical cow-calf production system in Oklahoma has got some advantages relative to heat stress as opposed to what we might see in feedlot situations. Typically, those cows are out on pasture. They're going to have more sources of shade. In a lot of cases, they're going to have access to a pond that they might even stand in for certain parts of the day that helps them with a little bit of evaporative cooling. But as the temperatures go up, certain things we want to keep in mind relative to cow-calf producers and avoiding heat stress. If we get to the point that we see cows actually doing open mouth breathing, we know we're dealing with heat stress. Anytime that we see night temperatures not getting to 70 or below, we know we're going to be in situations where cows are going to have a hard time offloading heat that builds up as a result of grazing and digestive activity through the course of the day. And anytime we're above 85 degrees for a high, we're potentially going to see cows that get heat stress. So what are some things we can do, keeping that in mind? Following up on last week's theme, we want to keep an abundant supply of fresh, clean water out for our cows and for our calves. Furthermore, in addition to just knowing we've got enough of a fresh supply of clean water out for them, if we're actually talking about some sort of an automatic waterer, if we can get a shade over that to actually keep that water a little bit cooler, it works to our advantage. If we've got to work cows, move cows at this time of year, it is best to start that activity at about daylight and try to get it done in the morning hours of the day. As I mentioned earlier, typically cows' body temperature is going to increase through the course of a day. If our daily high occurs at somewhere around 4 p.m. and we've seen cows grazing through the morning, that heat that results as a result of digesting fiber is going to continue to build body temperature for another 4 to 6 hours past that. So we want to avoid working cows later in the day, avoid working them in the evening. Try to work cows, if at all possible, in the morning hours this time of year. So some things to keep in mind in addition, provide shade if we can. If we've got a source of shade for cows, let's be cautious about where we stack hay relative to that. If we're building a shade, let's think about where it sets relative to, say, tall standing forage that might block airflow, because we want to create as much airflow through those shaded areas as possible. A little higher shade permits airflow going along over the top of the cows as opposed to something that sets a little too low. Hope this helps. All these things to keep in mind as we try to prevent heat stress and keep our cow as healthy, cow herds as healthy and productive as possible.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
One session of this week's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Seattle featured a food security ministers meeting, chaired by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The APEC community shares a commitment to addressing global food needs now so that we can, in fact, build the resilient systems that can absorb future shocks like pandemics, conflict, severe weather, and a changing climate.
The secretary and ministerial colleagues discuss climate solutions through agriculture, including the U.S.-based Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities. To that end, our nation and USDA announced two new initiatives. One is a food security dashboard that provides global decision makers data in areas such as trade disruptions and food insecurity. Also, interim field guides will be published, covering subjects such as sustainable agricultural practices and public-private partnerships to address food security issues. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.